Colonel Warburton, Real 8. Now, you took over command as Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel, in charge of the South Notts Hussars on the 12th of November, 1953. And I wanted to ask how you went about, what were your first things you set about doing when you took over? I mean, because you'd been under other people, now you were in command. How did you set about sorting it out?
Well, it was clear to me at that time that a different approach to the recruitment of officers, particularly, was required.
In what way?
Bearing in mind the reputation of my predecessor. Well, see, I had really a little bit of tearing up to do after that, if you could imagine.
What sort of thing?
Well, there were one or two potential officer people who I didn't really think were suitable to be officers. And they had to be sorted out. But eventually, we had a very fine set of young officers.
Now, what were you looking for in a young officer?
Well, I was setting my standard by my previous regiment as an SP on and RHA regiment. And I expected only the highest performance, which wasn't that easy to find that time.
Where did you look? Because Birkin had looked very much in the rugby club.
Yes,
he was bigger.
That was the problem, because I really didn't know Nottingham very well. But we used to advertise to some extent, and the East Midlands Association, or the County's territorial association, was very helpful in having recruiting drives within the county, and we picked up officers and men from those drives. They used to advertise in the local press fairly regularly, and we did get occasional people coming in from the Army Recruiting Office as well.
Now, one of the young officers that we hadn't mentioned so far, or not so young actually, was Westlake, Charles Westlake.
Charles Westlake was in the regiment when I joined it, and he had been with him throughout the war. And so it was a very valuable asset to the officers with his previous experience.
What did you think of Westlake as an officer? Was he efficient?
He was efficient and reliable as an officer.
Did he have any of the problems? I mean, he'd been a pre-war territorial gunner and then NCO. I mean, had he had enough experience for you to sort of, and training to for you to consider efficient?
His previous experience was very valuable in training. I don't know what eventually happened to him. Did he eventually have a battery? I think he did.
He had 426 battery from 53 to 58, so before he was replaced by Major Gunn.
Yeah, yes.
But were you happy with the way he commanded 426?
Yes, I was very happy to have him as a battery commander.
And just to pick up on the other ones, Major Gunn.
Major Gunn was a different He was a higher caliber officer, in my view.
In what way? What was so good about him?
he was much more able to handle men and had all the natural makings of an officer. I don't know.
Where'd you got him from? Where'd you got him from?
I can't remember how he came into the regiment.
Was it obvious that he had the capacity to go further? Because he became colonel of the regiment, didn't he?
It was obvious that he was going to go further, yes.
And what about Major Lowe, D.L. Lowe, Major Lowe, took over 520 battery in 1957-58 from Major Derbyshire?
I can't even remember him. It wasn't a regular, was it? We did get a training major at one time.
I don't know, I must be honest. Now, one thing that I know was close to your heart was that you seem to have almost immediately set about forming a regimental band, because there was an authorisation for the formation in March 1954, which is only 3 or 4 months after you took over. Yeah. Could you explain why you were so keen? Was it you that pushed this, or what? How did the band come to form?
I realised that the regiment had a band pre-war, and I first of all tried to find out what had happened to the instruments and the music, but they had all disappeared, so that any ideas of a band had to be started from scratch. Well, at that time, I think James Gunn was second in command, I'm not sure. But I think James Gunn was second in command. In any event, he was the most musically inclined officer I had. So I suggested to him that it would be a good idea if we formed the band. We tried to reform the band, and he agreed to help in this, and we set about the task of defining instruments and music and musicians. We eventually found somebody who was considered fit to be bandmaster from a local brass band, and I can't remember who it was, but it was from a local brass band. And
would that be Warrant Officer Ryder? He seems to have been your first.
I think it was.
And Captain, he was Captain Gunn then, he wasn't second in command then, but he was president of the band committee.
Yes.
How did you actually go about getting the money and everything? Cause
this whole operation involved tremendous pressure being put on the Territorial Association for funds. But I had great support from the chairman of the County Association, and by bits and bobs we managed to collect the various instruments we required to form a band.
Where would you collect them from?
Well, we bought most of them. With their money, they gave us grants to buy these things. We had about 10 bandsmen with suitable instruments and music, and they were playing, making quite a pleasant noise.
Now, where did you get the men, the musicians from? Were they from the recruits you already had, or would you recruit separately?
Different people altogether. They were mainly musicians already playing in a band of some sort. And this formed the backbone of the band. And
why did you think a band was so important?
Well, I thought the rare occasions we had to march through Nottingham, since the army was closed and those sort of things, I think it was well important to have a band in front, their own band in front. And I was rather fond of brass band music anyway, and it fitted in very well. But we did have some frightful problems with it.
What sort of problems?
Well, we were always short of either instruments or men until we got up to about 30, and then we seemed to level out, and we're doing really playing very well indeed. And we used to play in London and those sort of things. But on our first, when we first started with our hardcore of 10 men, word had got round that we had this band and it was playing, and at one occasion I was asked if they would be able to play at the show and give a bit of marching exhibition as well. And I had to explain to the inquiry that the band could barely play standing up, never mind marching, but they were quite good sitting down, which gave some indication of the average age of our band, which was rather high. Nevertheless, we plodded on.
Did they have to do any military training? I mean, would they have to learn to march?
Well, they were supposed to learn to march. They had to march eventually. And they were trained to march if they couldn't already march.
Now, I believe you've got a story about your first bandmaster.
The first bandmaster we had was musically extremely well qualified. But he had never had a uniform on in his life before and knew very little about military discipline. And caused considerable problem when we took them to camp at West Arm, and on the morning walked around the lines with the CRA to advancing up a road, when in the distance I saw coming the other way our bandmaster, resplendent in his bandmaster's uniform. And luckily, I knew the brigadier well enough to tell him that the bandmaster was approaching and that anything could happen when he got alongside us. And in the event, as the bandmaster approached us, he took his hat off and said good morning, sir, to the brigadier, and then put his hat on back again. The brigadier saluted back in true fashion and took the whole scene very well indeed. But it was an astonishing sight. And the bandmaster was completely oblivious of any faux pas.
So, which bandmaster, I mean, when was there any key bandmaster who, I mean, that was the first one. It sounds like that was Ryder. That was the first bandmaster, anyway.
We progressed over the years, and eventually we had a very military bandmaster who had formerly been invited to reform the RAF band, but wanted to get into civilian life, and so came to us as bandmaster. And he stayed with us for several years.
Did he do a good job?
And did an excellent job. But eventually, there again, there was a bit of a sticky business somewhere. But I think it might be best covered by saying he preferred to go continue or expand his teaching facilities, because he used to teach people as well. But there was some chicanery somewhere happened. I don't quite know what it was, but he left anyway. about if I'd gone then, so I don't know what happened. But the band has progressed ever since, until this latest cut. And then the band was virtually told to pack up. But we managed, however, to make an arrangement with the Army Cadet Force. And so far, we know to continue. They're still a being now.
Now, when you were in command, how did you try and change the training you were doing with the you still had the sextants, didn't you, in 1953?
Yes, we still had sextants then. I was trying to upgrade the training all the time.
In what way?
Well, the sextant was new to nearly all of the recruits. And although they were gunner recruits, they had only seen the Tobe 25 Palmer. And the sextant requires rather different treatment to the Tobe 25 Palmer. And we were lucky at that time, we were able to take our vehicle slings up to protest and practice on the open ground bar. Purchase now all of them as well.
What about the sort of technical gunnery training? Who was in charge of that?
Well, we had a training major we had quite a strong permanent staff in those days.
What would you say was their role? How did they, of the permanent staff,
a lot of the permanent staff was on the maintenance of these tanks, you see. They do take quite a lot of maintaining. So we had a regular sort of remit people who looked after these things. And of course they did train the people on the mechanical side of the equipment. We had a Remy officer, I think.
Was that part of the light aid detachment, or would that be different?
There certainly should be a Remy officer somewhere, and I'm sure we had one. There normally was one.
And what other permanent staff would you have?
Permanent RSM, he was a regular. And we had one or two PSIs, I think we used to call them, permanent staff instructors on the staff, who were sergeants or sergeant majors.
So they would do most of the gunnery?
They would do most of the training, the recruits, and things like that.
And
the officer training would be done more often by a training major. We had a training major attached to the regiment. He used to take classes.
And he'd be permanent as well. He was a regular as well.
He was a permanent, yeah.
What was the quality of the permanent staff? I mean, did you get good trainers, or were they deadbeats?
We have to vet them very carefully. I had one. I can't remember his name now, but he lasted about 10 minutes. No, not quite like that, but he didn't last very long. But obviously, we didn't always get the quality permanent staff that I thought they ought to have. And of course, the quartermaster was always a permanent, a regular.
Yeah.
We had some very good quartermasters.
Now, in 1955, the permanent staff at Ottoburn was cancelled because of the rail strike.
Yes.
How did that affect you? I mean, do you remember? Because you seem to have organised a load of courses at Lille.
It didn't, because we had a round robin in the regiment, and we paid the regiment out of cash. We actually paid for that. I would like to tell you who paid the bulk of it, but the bulk was paid by one of our officers.
Who was that?
Well, it was only one, yes. It wasn't me. We all chipped in as much as we could.
Foreman Hardy.
We never wanted anybody to know.
And what What did that money go to pay for? Because the camp was cancelled.
Well, it just got rid of the camp, and that's it. We did the camp as normal.
So it wasn't cancelled?
Not as far as we were concerned, no. I think that's the one we're talking about. I know there was one, which we were all teed up that it was off and that it was cancelled. But we went somehow. Well, and then we're writing a pathetic letter of arms to all officers, the next officers, and we collected all the money.
Now, what about, you have a story of the Queen being tricked into reviewing the ritual. Could you tell that whole story? Because that was a good story.
I think it was the next year. No, it couldn't have been. The last year of my command, I had 52, I think I'd gone for 5 years, didn't I? 58.
53
to 58. The Queen was coming to Nottingham to visit the Royal Show. I think the Royal Show was being held in Nottingham. Or some show like that. And in the very early days, it was agreed that we would fire a salute on in the park where they have the goose fair, you know, up there. It's not the park. It's I can't remember where it is, but it's not the park. It's a big open space where they have the goose fair in Nottingham.
Just below the cemetery.
That's it. I don't know what they call it. Anyway, having fired the salute, this had to be done while the Queen was in Nottingham because she didn't like hearing explosions from there. So I thought it would be an excellent idea if we could persuade the Queen to inspect the battery on this, what do they call this damn place, on her way to her next call. And accordingly, I gave orders that the SPs were to be prepared, suitable for a royal inspection. And the men entered wholeheartedly into this venture and got the SPs looking superbly, you know, cleaned up, painted, polished, already. When the bombshell came, a message was received that the Queen would not be able to visit the guns as the schedule was so tight that it had to be cut out. Well, that didn't suit me one bit. So, fortunately, I was on good terms with the town clerk at that time, who I think was Tom Owen, who subsequently got into trouble for doing something, which would be a bit outspoken. He fell out with the chief constable, that was it, and the chief constable. And in between this, I had been summoned to see the Adjutant General in London to officially tell me the news. The general in charge of 49 days, who were stationed in Bestwood at that time, instructed me to take his G1 with him, who was a guards officer. And we duly arrived at the War Office. We were taken into the Adjutant General's office, who fortunately had been my CRA in the war. And he told the G1 to disappear for the next room while we had a talk. And he passed the news on to me, full of apologies for having to do it. that said that he would do his utmost if found that it reversed. Probably, I collected the G1 and we actually went to Claridge's for lunch. Then we went home and we came back to Nottingham. I dare not tell the regiment the full story. The thing was off us. And eventually, after waiting for a day or two, I received a telegram from Holyrood House, I think, in Edinburgh, saying, confirming that the Queen on no account would stop and look at the regiment. So I still could not bring myself to tell the regiment this, so I decided to approach the town clerk and the chief constable to see if we could arrange something between us, which we did. The arrangement being that the Queen would be rerouted for a short distance to pass the guns. And that was agreed so that she would in fact drive past the guns and the guns would see her. But then it occurred to me that having got that there, we could might do one better. So I asked the chief constable if he could get one of the policemen to stop the car at a suitable place along the when they were near the guns. And I would be standing there to open the car door for the Queen to get out and hope very much that she would. And in the event they agreed to this, and they did stop the car, and I did open the door, and the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh both got out, and I took them round the guns and put them back in my car again. So Honor was done all right, and the guns never knew what, never knew the drama that had been going on behind the scenes.
How did the Queen seem? I mean,
the Queen seemed very, very pleased and was very happy about everything, and very charming. And I was quite expected to be court-martialed after the event. But instead of which, I was invited to become an ADC to the Queen. This is really the facts of the case, but it was really quite enjoyable. I thought it was enjoyable.